Hi, writers. Welcome to a new episode in our series on writing fiction, both novels and short stories. This is Jim Thayer. Enough dilly-dallying. Let's get to work. I'd like to talk about the difference between literary and commercial novels. Nancy Kress is a science fiction writer who has won both the prestigious Hugo and Nebula Awards. She's also a terrific writer on writing. She has written on the difference between literary and commercial fiction in an article in The Complete Handbook of Novel Writing. She asks regarding the difference, as you write, how aware should you be of your audience? How much should you be shaping your material to please that audience? Nancy Kress asks in the article, what's the difference? She writes, in general, fiction is divided into literary fiction and commercial fiction. Nobody can definitely or definitively say what separates one from the other, but that doesn't stop everybody, including me, from trying. Your book probably will be perceived as one or the other, and that will affect how it is read, packaged, and marketed. Nancy Kress continues, literary fiction pays more attention to style than does commercial fiction. Usually, it also probes characterization more deeply. It's often slower paced than commercial fiction because added description and character development take up many words. The typical worldview implied by literary fiction is complex and ambiguous, trying to be faithful to the complexity and ambiguity of life. A traditional happy ending is possible, but not usual. Its themes are timeless. Ezra Pound defined literature as, quote, news that stays news. Nancy Kress goes on in her article, Toni Morrison writes literary fiction, so do John Updike, Paul Marshall, Ann Tyler, Dan McCall, Alice Hoffman, and most of the short story writers published in The New Yorker. And Nancy Kress says, commercial fiction can be just as well written, but in an entirely different way. It's usually faster paced, with a stronger plot line, higher stakes, more danger. Characterization can range from good to practically non-existent. The style is usually transparent, which means the writer wants to tell a story in words that don't call attention to themselves, so the story itself, and not the style, receives the attention. Nancy Kress adds, what makes commercial fiction commercial is that editors expect to make a profit from selling it, not always true of literary fiction. The larger the audience, the better. And audiences for commercial fiction are larger than those for literary fiction. As Mickey Spillane pointed out, those big-shot writers could never dig the fact that there are more salted peanuts consumed than caviar. Commercial fiction writers include Tom Clancy, Stephen King, Danielle Steele, Judith Krantz, and John Grisham. And Nancy Kress continues in her article, thus, your first step in considering your audience is to define what sort of book you're writing. Why? Because the answer will determine what your book must include to sell it to an editor. It may be a graceful style, or penetrating character insights, or a happy ending, or detailed and accurate descriptions of police work. You discover what your kind of fiction requires by reading it, a lot of it, constantly, with interest and, one hopes, some amount of appreciation. Nancy Kress goes on to say that many writers are both literary and commercial. She says, you may be one of those writers who holds a dual image of what you're writing as you write it. Part of the dual image writer's mind is always immersed in the story, living and breathing and feeling it along with the characters. The other part holds itself back a bit, looking at the words on the screen from a distance, weighing and judging. If you are this sort of writer, it may indeed be helpful to assign the weighing and judging to a definite image of your audience. Let him or her or them decide what to keep in, what to delete, in what direction to move the plot. And Nancy Kress goes on, if you're a different sort of writer, however, don't split yourself in two while writing. Every atom of your being is involved in the story, and trying to please an imaginary onlooker only paralyzes the creative flow. Forget the audience while you write your first draft. Evoke that audience when you go through the second draft, revising and polishing. After all, an audience may be more welcome at a dress rehearsal rather than a first read-through. And then she concludes the article, all right, everybody, places, open the curtain. This has been Nancy Kress on the difference between literary and commercial fiction. I'd like to add that the difference between literary and commercial isn't always clear, as she points that out, and that stories appear on a continuum between literary and commercial. Some of them are clearly commercial, and some are clearly literary. But there's a lot of novels, many, many novels, maybe most novels, that are somewhere in between. Nancy Kress says John Grisham is a commercial writer, but what about his novel A Painted House, a portrait of a family in the rural South in the 1950s. The characters, particularly the protagonist, 7-year-old Luke, and Luke's dreamy, resigned mother, are deeply drawn. The settings are crafted with high skill. The observations are sharp, including one of my favorite observations of all time, Grisham's comment that at the picnic, there were a dozen bowls of potato salad, and none of them looked alike. Grisham's writing is as good as is found in any literary novel. These elements signify that Painted House is a literary novel. Yet the novel also has a strong plot filled with forward momentum, a bully from the hills, a fire, a cranky grandfather, a bully from Mexico, a lazy deputy sheriff, a stolen truck, a beautiful young lady likely to stir up passions. So which is it, literary, commercial, or commercial? It's a hybrid. It's a wonderful novel, and it sits between literary and commercial. This is true of many novels. I just finished reading two novels by Tony Early. Jim the Boy, which features a 10-year-old protagonist, Jim Glass, in 1934, and its sequel, The Blue Star, set 7 years later in 1941. It's really, really lovely novel set in North Carolina. They're coming-of-age stories with strong literary writing and close examinations of a young man and his family. There are layers of character development, but there's also a lot of plot. Bullies and some awful people doing terrible things, and school dances, fierce dogs, a sailor who dies at Pearl Harbor, and many other elements in these novels. I really enjoyed both novels, and Tony Early is a strong writer. Are his novels literary or commercial? I don't know. Let me suggest what his goal might have been writing these novels, and what John Grisham's goal likely was when writing A Painted House, and what our goal might be. Come up with a strong story and tell it in the best sentence-by-sentence writing we can. Rather than consigning our story to the literary or commercial categories, we'll write a strong story with strong writing. It'll be the best novel we can write, without the elusive constraints of aiming for a literary or commercial product. Strong story, strong writing, seems like a good formula. Here is something fun and, in fact, delightful. These podcasts were mentioned in a column in London's big newspaper, The Telegraph. Columnist William Sitwell wrote in The Telegraph, I've got 20 minutes to walk Cyrus, 20 minutes exactly to listen to a new edition of Jim Thayer's brilliant novel-writing podcast. then start the next piece and be done by 6:15, ready for the kids' bath time. William Sitwell is a well-regarded writer, and I'm grateful for his comment. I hope it doesn't go to my head. This is from Benjamin in Perth, about his writing path. Benjamin writes, "My own personal journey on why I decided to become a writer stems from when I was 12 years old. In the year 2000, my father decided to take my younger brother and me around Australia to experience this great big brown and barren land of ours. My father was a prospector, digging up gold and teaching others the craft. Because of this, my brother and I were homeschooled in the outback. We lived in tents for a few years and didn't have access to the same entertainment as other kids our age. Sometimes it would be weeks between even seeing a TV, and so my most cherished joy was the books I would take into the bush. Instead of computer games, my brother and I used our imagination and built cities of rock structures in the desert. We used our toy cars to craft roads in the sand and play in these stone metropolises. Soon I began writing stories about my little rock towns, and sure enough, this blossomed into creating an entire world of made-up cities and countries. To this day, I have a wealth of documents from that time of maps and stories about these creations. In fact, my first completed novel, which I will be publishing soon, borrows from these names and places I invented as a young boy, although my urban planning credentials left much to be desired." That's from Benjamin in Australia, in Perth. He writes that Australia is a great big brown and barren land of ours. He's painting with a broad brush. I've been to Australia several times, in a more beautiful country is hard to imagine. Benjamin's father was a gold prospector, and Benjamin spent much of his childhood out in the bush without TV and probably without video games, and so he turned to writing. What a nice story. A funny thing happens to me about once a week. I'll be sitting at my desk in front of my laptop. My cat, Jack, will be there, companionably keeping me company, sitting right in front of me, and I have to reach around him to type. And abruptly, my computer will start doing weird things. The cursor will bounce around on the screen, and the screen will scroll crazily. None of the keyboard keys work. The mouse seems out of commission. My first thought in those seconds is, uh-oh, I hope I don't need a new computer. And it always takes me 8 or 10 seconds to determine what is happening. Jack has placed his paw on the laptop's touchpad. So I scoot his paw off and everything is back to normal. When Charles Dickens was 12 years old, because his father had been imprisoned for debt, Charles was taken out of school and sent to work in a boot polish factory. And now this, with my laptop and Jack. Ah, the burdens of being a writer, the suffering. One of the best ways to learn to write compelling dialogue is to read skilled writers of dialogue. Crime fiction is particularly noted for strong dialogue, and it's helpful to read good crime dialogue, even if you aren't writing a mystery or a police procedural. Here's a list of some of the best dialogue writers, and it's from the UK's Guardian newspaper in a piece by Andrew Martin, and is titled Best Dialogue in Crime Fiction, the top 10. Number one from Andrew Martin's list in The Guardian is from The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. Andrew Martin says, "At the start of this novel, the detective Sam Spade's secretary, Effie Perrine, says, 'There's a girl wants to see you. Her name is Wonderly.' 'A customer?' 'I guess so. You'll want to see her anyway. She's a knockout.' 'Shoo her in, darling,' said Spade. 'Shoo her in.' Number two, from Farewell, My Lovely by Raymond Chandler. Andrew Martin writes, Mr. Lindsay Marriott asks the detective Marlowe to accompany him on a rendezvous, but won't say why. Marlowe suggests, you just want me to go along and hold your hat, which annoys Marriott. I'm afraid I don't like your manner, he said, using the edge of his voice. I've had complaints about it, I said, but nothing seems to do any good. Andrew Martin writes, Marlowe was irresistible, partly because being laconic signifies bravery. Later on, he says to another character, I talk too much when I'm scared, too. But in fact, Marlowe never talks too much. Number three is from Evil Under the Sun by Agatha Christie. The writer of this piece in The Guardian, Andrew Martin, says that Christie's dialogue is underrated. The fastidious tone gives away the first speaker in this conversation about sailing as Poirot. The personalities of the vicar and the major are also immediately evident from just a few words. There is no such thing as a really calm sea. Always, always there is motion. If you ask me, said Major Barry, seasickness is 9/10 nerves. There, said the clergyman, smiling a little, speaks the good sailor, eh, Major? Only been ill once, and that was crossing the channel. Number four, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. Andrew Martin, in his article, writes, The tormenting of the unnamed narrator, new mistress of the house called Manderley, by the baleful housekeeper, Mrs. Danvers, is as relishably nasty as anything in the genre. I don't have a maid, I said awkwardly. I'm sure Alice, if she is the housemaid, will look after me all right. Mrs. Danvers wore the same expression that she had done on our first meeting when I dropped my gloves so gauchely on the floor. I'm afraid that would not do for very long, she said. It's usual, you know, for ladies in your position to have a personal maid. Number five in Andrew Martin's list in The Guardian is dialogue from Strangers on a Train by Patricia Highsmith. Martin writes, Here, the relentlessly pushy Charles Anthony Bruno is beginning the entrapment of Guy Haines into his plan for the perfect double murder. Shall I tell you one of my ideas for murdering my father? No, Guy said. He put his hand over the glass Bruno was about to refill. Which do you want, the busted light socket in the bathroom or the carbon monoxide garage? Do it and stop talking about it. Andrew Martin writes, The insinuating tone of Bruno is the chief delight of a brilliant novel. Number six, Billion Dollar Brain by Len Deighton. And Andrew Martin writes that the KGB man here, Colonel Stock, has just chided him for fraternizing with evil enemies of Russia. Our hero responds, But in my experience, there aren't many evil people around, just ill-informed, misguided, and ignorant ones. Colonel Stock said, In Russia, our people are not misinformed. There are many people who think that water has no taste, I said, because we were born with it in our mouths, and it's been there ever since. Andrew Martin adds, What I like about Deighton's books are these moments of elliptical weirdness that contrast so effectively with the terseness of the prose and the sharpness of the plotting. Number seven is Night Train by Martin Amis. Amis has said of dialogue that it is easy to write, quote, like riding a bike downhill. And Andrew Martin adds, but he's very good at it, as demonstrated in this hard-boiled crime novel set in what is probably L.A. The female detective, Houlihan, is quizzing the partner of Jennifer Rockwell, an astrophysicist who committed suicide. You guys were building for the future? Such was my understanding. Get married, kids. Such was my understanding. You two talked about it? I asked if you talked about it. Okay, kids. You want kids. You yourself? Sure, I'm 35. You begin to want to see a fresh face. Number 8 is Be Cool by Elmore Leonard. And this is the second book concerning the misadventures in show business of Chili Palmer, who is encountering here, getting off on the wrong foot with a dangerous Raji. You wear your shades at night, Chili said, so I'll think you're cool, but I can't tell if you're looking at me. Raji put his glasses down on his nose, down and up. See, I'm looking the hell right at you, man. You have something to say to me, say it, so we be done with it here. Andrew Martin adds, It's the sudden lurch towards confrontation that Leonard so good at. Number 9 is No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy. And Andrew Martin writes, here, Sheriff Ed Tom Bell and his deputy, Wendell, view the aftermath of a drug-related gunfight in the Texas desert. McCarthy doesn't use speech marks or apostrophes in his dialogue, which is irritating. But Wendell speaks first. Could have been checking the quality, getting ready to trade. They didn't trade, they shot each other. Bell nodded. There might not have even been no money. That's possible. But you don't believe it? Bell thought about it. No, he said, probably I don't. Andrew Martin says in his piece, what I like about the line, there might not have even been money, is that it's both highly ornate and completely natural. Here's the last one from the novel Snowdrops by A.D. Miller, which Andrew Martin writes is a creepy tale of a young English lawyer, Nick, who is seduced in Moscow by a scheming Russian woman called Masha. I said, how is your mother, Masha? Not bad, she said, but very tired, coming old now. I would like to meet her. One day, maybe. How's your job? I pretend work, they pretend to pay me. This has been novelist Andrew Martin's list of great crime fiction dialogue in The Guardian. I like knowing his selection. Reading snappy dialogue is a great pleasure. Maybe we can sharpen our own dialogue that we write by reading great dialogue. Sometimes we talk about a difficult technique, such as coming up with a fresh metaphor that doesn't sound like a reach. Finding a balance is hard. But other times we talk about a technique that's easy. It's easy to learn, but it's highly important. That is, that it's easy to learn doesn't mean it's not important. It's critical. Readers appreciate this technique we'll talk about now because it makes a story much more immediate and vivid. And the reader often doesn't know why it's immediate and vivid, but it is. Let's talk about the importance of avoiding too many filters. As I've mentioned before, John Gardner in his book, The Art of Fiction, talks about filtering, which is, he says, the needless filtering of the image through some observing consciousness. The amateur writes, quote, turning, she noticed two snakes fighting in among the rocks. Compare that with, she turned, in among the rocks, two snakes were fighting. Generally speaking, though not laws are absolute in fiction, vividness urges that almost every occurrence of such phrases as, she noticed, and she saw, be suppressed in favor of direct presentation of the thing seen. That's John Gardner. The filter is a common fault. The writer, when using a filter, the writer asks the reader to look at rather than through the character. In this phrase, Nancy Drew watched the clock strike 10. Nancy Drew watched is a filter. The reader here is watching Nancy watch the clock rather than the reader watching the clock directly. Without the filter, the sentence is, the clock struck 10. Nancy heard the owl mournfully hoot, where Nancy heard is the filter. The reader is watching Nancy listen, rather than the reader listening directly. Without the filter, the sentence is, the owl mournfully hooted. The partial scene I'll read now has too much filtering of the image through an observing consciousness, which is Jones's. Here, I'll read it. Jones noticed that the chest was locked. He saw that the leather straps that circle the chest were frayed. He didn't have a key, but he might be able to pry open the chest. Then he saw that one of the hinges was rusted through, and he noticed that the lock was rusted too. He might be able to open it without any tools. He yanked on it and saw that it popped open. It seemed too easy. Then he heard a rustling from further in the cave. He saw something move in the darkness. He was exhausted, and he watched his hands tremble. Here are all the filters. I'll read it again, and I'll pause to comment or point out the filters. Jones noticed, that's a filter, Jones noticed, that the chest was locked. He saw, there's another filter, that the leather straps that circled the chest were frayed. He didn't have a key, but he might be able to pry open the chest. Then he saw, there's a filter, that one of the hinges was rusted through, and he noticed, there's the filter, that the lock was rusted too. He might be able to open it without any tools. He yanked on it and saw, there's another filter, that it popped open. It seemed too easy. Then he heard, there's a filter, a rustling from further in the cave. He saw, there's a filter, something move in the darkness. He was exhausted, and he watched, there's a filter, his hands tremble. Now I'll read these paragraphs without the filters. Notice that instead of watching the protagonist, Jones, watch the action, we're watching the action directly. The chest was locked, and the leather straps that circled the chest were frayed. Jones didn't have a key, but he might be able to pry open the chest. One of the hinges was rusted through, and the lock was rusted too. He might be able to open it without any tools. He yanked on it, and it popped open. It seemed too easy. A rustling came from farther in the cave. Something moved in the darkness. He was exhausted, and his hands trembled. See how much more direct this version is? Instead of being somewhere in the air looking down at Jones as Jones explores the cave, the reader is right there with the chest and the hinges and the rustling in the cave without the filters. It's much more immediate, much more direct. We don't need to avoid all filters. Once in a while, they're good to change the texture of sentences or to remind the reader where the point of view is. So maybe Jones saw the chest was locked. This one filter's fine. But we writers should always question the use of filters. He saw, he heard, she noticed. Much of the time we can avoid using filters and our story will be more direct for the reader. My father, Lou Thayer, was a wheat farmer in eastern Washington state with a farm near Elmira, Washington. My dad, the farmer, would have made a great writer because he really knew how to work a plot. Yeah, I'm done. This is Jim Thayer. Please send me a message at jimthayerseattle@gmail.com. Until next time, please keep tapping those keys.